那么接下来呢，我们就要进入到我们今天的嘉宾对话环节。下面就有请我们今天的对话嘉宾，他是来自复旦大学国际公共事务学院的副教授，他也是金砖国家研究中心研究员朱洁静博士，有请。
大家好，大家下午好。我呢这个跟大家也一样啊，也是刚听了这个柯顿教授的发言啊，感觉呢确实呢就是把整个的这个脉络理得非常清楚。就是呢大家看到他这个一开始的时候讲这个就是从 G7 到G20， 然后中国在这个当中到底呢选择了什么样的这个就是我们是什么样的战略，就是什么样的角色。那么当然他用了一个词叫领导力，就是中国的这个就是在这个当中啊他是怎么样的发挥领导力。所以呢他最后概括出几个词，一个呢就是中国呢就是这个领导力呢他是比较谨慎的，就是中国并不是一开始的时候就是呢就很热烈的就是跟 G7 能够呢这个当然这个本身呢跟我们到底现在七国集团G7 它在这个全球治理当中发挥什么样的作用，那么跟我们中国我们想在国际舞台上在全球治理当中发挥什么样的作用有很大关系。第二个呢它概括出来的关键词呢叫做呢这个它说是这个逐步的，就是呢这个累积性的cumulative， 就是中国呢它实际上尽管是一开始很谨慎，但是呢中国的这个跟 G7 的关系，包括呢后来呢这个 G7 发起倡议成立了 G20， 那么在这个当中中国是逐步的发挥了这个领导力。那么当然呢它还有一个词就是 cooperative， 就是中国呢也是一个总体上讲中国基本上没有采取一个对抗的态势，那么呢是逐步的，虽然尽管一开始很谨慎，但是呢慢慢的呢这个它是一个合作型的这样的一个领导力。这个呢是他整个的演讲啊，大家看到就是从一开始的时候他就是他的这个观察他的结论，然后呢他就讲呢这个在这个历史的进程当中，从这个 G7 1975年成立，那么一直到90年代，那么冷战结束，那么呢跟中国呢开始了有了更多的这个接触，当然呢这个里面有一些不愉快的经历，就是呢89年，然后呢这个好的这个方面就是呢97年的东南亚金融危机让西方国家认识到我们这个当时在亚洲金融危机当中表现出来的这个负责任，我相信我们中国人呢都还记得那个画面，就当时朱镕基总理向世界庄严的这个承诺，说呢人民币不贬值。那么这个承诺呢实际上在很大程度上为中国当时跟 G7 的关系打开了一个大的这个突破，就是 G7 认识到呢就是中国在不光是在亚洲经济，就是中国在这个东南亚金融危机当中表现出来的这种负责任的行为啊，就是如果没有中国这个参与到这个全球治理进入领导层，那么呢这样的这个危机呢实际上是很难应对的，所以呢在这样的一个背景下，那么实际上呢 G7 呢就在考虑怎么样的呢这个怎么样的让中国，当然除了中国之外还有呢像印度像巴西像一系列的这个新兴经济体能够呢这个进入到呢这个全球治理的这样的一个就是我们讲的是leadership， 进入到这种这个治理的行列当中来。但是呢从这个柯顿教授的演讲当中大家看到其实这个过程呢是很漫长的，差不多是到08年之后，08年的这个金融危机再次让西方人呢又一次的感受到，就是呢如果不是真的下了决心让这些新兴经济体更平等的坐在一张桌子上，那么呢世界经济如果下一场危机到来的时候你发现呢还是没有办法。那么这个当中呢这个有了这个柯顿教授讲的这个8+5的对话，其实呢在这之前呢1999年德国呢明确的邀请了中国，说呢希望呢这个中国是不是可以进入到8国集团，把它变成9国集团，但中国很谨慎，中国呢强调一个呢就是确实呢这个我们这个很多方面啊就是对 G7 的认识，包括呢这个7国集团，其实柯顿教授一开始也讲了，就是 还是有价值观的因素，因为这个毕竟是脱胎于呢这个冷战的这个背景。那么二十世纪的全球治理，那么两次世界大战包括后来的冷战，那么诞生了这个 G7 七国集团，强调自己呢是一个呢西方民主国家的同盟，那么呢价值观的同盟。那么在这个当中，中国呢我觉得在一定的这个历史阶段我们保持谨慎，实际上是有它的道理。那么呢这个99年呢这个另外一个好一点的消息呢，就是除了德国邀请中国加入 G8， 中国拒绝了。那么另外一个呢，就是西方呢开始呢从这个财长会议，其实呢在这个 G20 里面大家看到，就是说这个除了领导人峰会之外，应该说呢最重要的会议呢就是财政部长跟央行长，因为这个呢实际上是一个核心的这种经济的宏观经济层面的这个讨论。那么呢为这个世界经济啊，就是大的这个经济政策的协调呢，在这个确立方向。所以呢这个 G20 的这个财长会议1999年诞生，那么中国呢在这个当中，中国是完全是另外一个的一个一样的一个态度，因为中国觉得呢在这个当中我们基本上仍然是保持了发展中国家的身份，我们并没有呢就是一下子呢就改变我们的这个就整个的这个对外的这样的一个身份立场。那么呢在这个当中还有印度，还有巴西，甚至呢你看还有更加的这个小一点的发展中国家，包括你像阿根廷、土耳其，像这些国家全部都进来。那么我们在保持了我们的这样的一个身份的这个前提下，那么呢进入到 G20， 但是在 G20 当中大家看到中国呢其实呢我们这个领导力啊，就是在2005年的这个香河会议当中，柯顿教授也提到，就是呢中国其实提了两个议题，一个就是推动国际金融的这个机构改革，就是要增加发展中国家在 IMF 跟世界银行话语权，另外一个呢就是呢在这个发展问题，就是怎么样的让 G20 能够帮助非 G20 的尤其是低收入的发展中国家发展。那么呢我觉得我们实际上是很好的平衡了，就是这个当时呢就是说我们一个方面要坚持是发展中国家，但是另外一个方面呢中国毕竟呢我们在世界经济当中体量越来越大，所以怎么样的做一个就是世界经济当中的稳定器，做一个呢这个负责任的大国，那么呢维持了一个很好的平衡。但是呢这个毕竟呢在这个柯顿教授的演讲当中，大家看到从99年开始一直到08年，那么呢这个财长会议呢基本上就这个态势，总体程度上呢这个受关注程度不高。尽管呢这个2005年当时呢这个保罗马丁呢就是加拿大的这个前总理提议呢是不是把 G20 的财长会提到呢这个领导人峰会，但是呢大家看美国呢小布什拒绝，我觉得骨子里面呢其实还是认为中国呢没有，就是或者说呢有价值观的因素，也有一个因素觉得中国还没有到那个份上，觉得呢是不是能够真的能够跟 G7 能够坐在同一张桌子上，而且平等的参与到规则制定。那么呢这个呢实际上在这个99年到08年呢其实也表现得很明显。然后呢大家看到这个柯顿教授也提到，这个其实呢08年是一个转折点，08年呢当这个那一年这个八国集团的峰会在日本的这个北海道，当时呢这个我也是去做这个学术调研，我印象非常深刻。08年差不多呢是一个其实现在回过头来看是一个转折性的一年。那一年中国办奥运会，然后呢从这个中国在国际舞台上的角色，日本呢办这个八国集团峰会，日本办这个八国集团峰会呢讨论的最多的话题那一年的这个是气候变化。然后呢那一年也是基本上大家感觉到所有的国际危机呢在这个08年的7月份都是集中的爆发。那么华尔街的这个金融的这个市场这个面临着很大的危机。另外一个呢大家看那个时候的粮食价格，这个国际这个粮食市场的粮食的价格也是空前的高。然后呢这个非洲呢出现了这个很多国家买不起粮食，然后这个国际的这个石油的价格，这个08年7月我印象很深刻，原油价格到了140多美元一桶，这个也是让西方的这个整个的世界经济感觉到呢，就是为什么就是出了这么多的危机，那么呢到底是什么原因导致的。那么呢这个八国集团在这个日本 开完会以后呢，很多的这个去看那年的公报啊，最后认为呢是新兴经济体呢在这个当中呢有很多行为啊没有跟他们做到很好的协调，所以呢对我们来说呢也是很明显的感受到，就是到底中国在全球治理当中应该要扮演一个什么样的角色。我们肯定是要坚持发展中国家身份，因为这个呢确实也是我们的国情。就是中国尽管经济总量这些方面我们是在不断的上升，但是你看中国的这个，如果说真的到人均，真的到基本的国情，在这个世界上我们的定位还是发展中国家。那么呢坚持这个身份的情况下怎么样的去平衡，那么呢这个时候呢，当然我觉得每一次其实都不是政治家的选择，都是呢这个世界的这个经济的客观的形势。那么08年9月15号雷曼兄弟破产，那么呢就是之前最抵制 G20 的这个开领导人峰会的小布什提议说呢，我们是不是要开这个 G20 的领导人峰会。那么呢这个最近大家看到一些这个传记当中呢这个就有披露出来，那么小布什呢这个第一个打电话问的就是中国，这个中国愿不愿意就是说参加这样的一个 G20 的领导人峰会，跟这个世界呢来共同的来应对这么一场金融危机。所以呢这个当然呢这个在这个之后啊，就是呢08年之后从华盛顿峰会开始一直呢到这个如果说简单的做这个阶段划分的话，08年到09年这个呢是金融危机最严重的时刻。那么中国呢这个我们这个跟在 G20 当中表现出来的就是共同的应对危机，那么力度呢也是非常的大，让西方呢也是感觉到呢就中国的这个负责任的大国的这一面。然后呢到这个10年之后，这个 G20 呢确实呢这个差不多我觉得一直到2015年都表现出来的一个问题，就大家始终感觉到如果说在没有危机的情况下是不是有可能真的能够做到发达国家跟发展中国家在平等的参与到全球经济治理，那么能够在设置议程，能够在达成共识这个方面，那么呢这个呢其实也是 G20 现在面临的一个很大的挑战，就在危机之后是不是大家真的还能够同舟共济，能够像危机当中那样的去合作。那么2016年杭州峰会，那么呢刚才呢柯顿教授最后呢也谈到就是呢这个确实呢从我们现在这个年初开始我们的议程到这个整个的这个峰会之前我们的筹备，那么呢总体的思路我们是希望杭州成为 G20 的一个新的起点，那就是真正的在一个如果在没有那么严重的危机的情况下，那么发达国家跟发展中国家是不是真的能够平等的坐在桌子上，而且能够呢叫同舟共济合作共赢。那么呢这个呢当然呢现在看来呢就是还是非常乐观的啊，就是呢杭州峰会呢有很多成果呢其实呢都是在这个指向这个方面。好，我刚才呢主要是想呢把这个柯顿教授的演讲的内容啊就是呢这个按照我的理解呢跟大家这个做个汇报。下面呢我想呢就是把我呢这个在这个厅当中啊这个有一些问题跟柯顿教授呢做一个交流。那么首先呢我想就是问的一个问题呢就是这个我们如果再回过头去看一看这个七国集团的这个诞生的历史。那么呢这个七国集团呢其实呢这个诞生的时候呢也是因为危机。就是70年代大家知道这个1970年代呢也是呢这个世界经济的危机呢这个集中爆发的时候，那就是呢当时呢这个石油的危机，金融市场的危机，然后呢包括这个中东的战争，那么呢这个美国也是在这个越战之后呢这个很长一段时间内呢感觉到自己呢无力在这个维护呢世界经济，那么这个去承担这么大的责任。那么在这种情况下呢这个 G7 呢这个开始呢这个形成了这样一个想法。那么尤其是当时呢这个法国跟德国，那么也是从财政部长这个层面开始，那么呢这个开始有这个 G5, 那么五国集团的这个财长会议，然后升级到了这个1975年这个 G7 的这个领导人峰会。所以呢这个我的问题呢就是呢 希望这个柯顿教授，就是说当时的也是一种危机催生的机制。那么从 G7 这个75年诞生以后，到了这个80年代，这个当然这个大家说呢， G7 这个还是在80年代很成功的这个一段合作，是怎么样的这个完成了这样的一个机制的转型。就是说如果在没有危机的情况下，大家还是不是能够紧紧的这个团结在一起，而且呢这个平等的呢去设置议程，去这个进行全球治理。
Learn several things. The first is that we still need the G7 for many reasons. Our global problems are great and growing. Let me just pick one, climate change. Last month, July, was the warmest, hottest month on the planet in recorded history. Every month in the last year has been hotter than that month has ever been before. So we're reaching critical thresholds. We know that we're soon going to hit the thresholds in which catastrophic climate change could be unleashed. So if our global problems are so great and growing, the demand for global governance is great and growing, and the G20 cannot do it all by itself. Because one of the greatest mistakes made by our G20 governors, and I've emphasized their success, was that after 2010, when they did a terrific job of crisis response, we're starting to do a good job on crisis prevention in the Euro crisis, they went into semi-retirement, started to work only half-time. They used to have two summits a year, and then they started to have only one, at ever greater intervals. So we need at least two summits a year, and the other one has come from the G7, with help from the BRICS, too. All members like the now G7 one, part of the G20. You can look at specific issues. Let me take climate change. The G7, brought to you by Angela Merkel at Elmau in 2015, did a lot for climate change. The one in November in Antalya, Turkey, did nothing. The G7 in Japan this year did virtually nothing, which is why we need the Hangzhou summit to do a great deal. So given our great and growing problems, you need both as an insurance policy. You also need, when they both act in the same year on a global problem, a tax, for example. You know, you make some progress, and then half a year you make a little more rather than having to wait another year. Also, there are issues that some deal with that the others don't, that need to be addressed cooperatively. In the old days, so you could leave it to the United States to do it all by itself. Canadians didn't always like that because they didn't do it our way. But the bigger danger now is you leave it to the United States to lead all by itself. It's so consumed by Trumpism that it just won't. The isolationist United States, as we saw in the mid-1970s, are returning again. And even though the G20 is beginning to bond as a group of individuals, and we saw that reach almost perfection at the Ottawa meeting in 2001, they're not as much by any means as an interpersonal club as the G7 is. So there are still some functions that only the G7 can do. In the autumn of 2008, when the financial system was collapsing, even though G20 finance ministers and central bankers had been meeting for almost a decade, it was still the G7 finance ministers and their central bankers who were the ones who got together October 7th, as I recall, and injected massive amounts of new liquidity into the global financial system. So they were the first responders while the G20 ones weren't there. And that's still true. So we need, I think, to develop a greater sense of oneness, a rapid response, immediate response in this fast-moving, interconnected world in the G20 across all issues and at all levels. We're making progress. The number and breadth of meetings, the personal representatives, the ministerial meetings, the official working groups, the engagement groups during China's presidency has been a big step forward in that, but there's still a long way to go. We need fast global governance, unified global governance to confront the problems we now face. And so far, we still have to rely on the G7 to do some pretty critical jobs there.
Yes. Okay. 我觉得呢，确实刚才柯顿教授讲的呢，我也认可。就是确实现在呢 ，G7 和这个 G20 呢，在当今的这个全球治理当中有各自的角色。但是呢，我感觉呢，就是可能呢，就是在如果是在某些情况下，比如说像这个俄罗斯跟这个G7 的关系，那么呢，如果是从这个历史来看的话，那么 G7， 那么现在呢，我是呢这个坦率的讲呢，是有一些担心的，就是如果他还是很强调这种就是在全球经济治理当中啊，还强调呢就是必须是这种有共同的价值观，他才能够呢这个去共同的治理呢，那么呢我觉得其实在很多情况下呢，反而呢就是会造成一些呢就是大家呢就是很容易产生分歧，那么怎么样的呢就是让 G7 也变得更加的这种就是真正的这种 open minded， 就是更加的开放啊、我觉得呢就是特别是从这个俄罗斯跟就是加入七国集团到后来呢，就是现在呢，这个乌克兰危机之后，这一段历史就是可以去看呢，就是怎么样的让 G7 呢，就是在很多方面呢，就是跟 G20 之间呢，保持的是一种更加的，就是说，我觉得呢，它是一个支撑性的角色，而不是呢，在这个当中呢，仍然是扮演这个领导的角色，就怎么样的去让 G7 能够有一些这样的改变。
In many ways, some of which they've used in the past, they could always invite the Secretary General of the United Nations to attend their summit. They could invite the leader of the International Labor Organization, Guy Ryder, to attend G7 summit sessions where they talk about employment and jobs. Patricia Figueres, the head of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change Secretariat for their climate change agenda and so on down the line. This they did not do at the last G7 summit. They could invite the leaders of Africa to their summit. They used to do that routinely, a lot of them, but they didn't last time on the whole. So they are moving backwards in some respects. But let me come back to Russia. Which is the biggest failure of G7-8 governance so far. Clubs do have criteria to get into the G20, and there's a debate about membership. You have to be big enough and connected enough. You have to be systemically significant. And in the beginning, when Paul Martin and Larry Summers were choosing, according to that formula, they got it right. And that's why membership in the G20 hasn't changed to that day. To be a member of the G7 from the beginning, you had to be a major power and a democratic one. So as soon as Russia met the two criteria, and it was becoming less great than the Soviet Union had used to be, but it had chosen democracy, it became a member, hence Birmingham 1998. But there are some rules, not just of the G7, but of the civilized international system. One of them is don't commit aggression and annex the territory of your neighbor or through military force. Saddam Hussein did that at the dawn of the post-Cold War era in 1990 by Kuwait, and the entire international community, the United Nations, said no and reversed that. So the G7 has faced and still faces the challenge of how do we get Russia to return to the fold. It will involve a democratizing Russia, but I'm optimistic that it will happen soon. It's quite difficult to see how, with President Putin still representing Russia, but we do have to bring President Putin to his senses before he brings the Russian people to their knees. It's just tragic, the amount of pain we're inflicting on our neighbors. I speak as a Canadian. Our next door neighbors, our other superpower neighbor, their economy is shrinking. Other young people are leaving or not being born. We need to get them back into the family, back on track, and that's why it's good that the G7 leaders still meet regularly, all of them, with Vladimir Putin through the G20. And I think it's unfortunate that Mr. Putin has chosen at Hangzhou to cancel a meeting he was supposed to have over Ukraine, over the Minsk agreements, with the leaders of France and Germany. But he has taken the step backwards, not the G7 members at Hangzhou. So one of the challenges for a Chinese leadership, I think, is to have a chat with Mr. Putin. It could be at the BRICS summit, just before the Hangzhou summit, and help him realize how he and his people are better off turning course, going back to they were as members of both the G20 and the G8 family 2-3 years ago.
其实呢，我们看这个中国在这个就是国际舞台上的角色啊，就从80年代我们开始提出来，就是呢，不以意识形态划线，就是呢，不要呢这个受很多的这种，特别是这种去意识形态，我们呢这个是一个全方位的这个外交。那么在这个当中呢，在这个 G20 当中啊，我觉得其实中国呢就是呢在倡导一种呢。就是不同的国家，那么它呢这个国情不一样，它的经济政策包括政治制度很多方面不一样，但是怎么样的在这种克服这种差异的基础之上，能够呢大家呢能够呢共同的来应对全球经济的挑战，就是呢尽量的去超越啊，就是呢就是我觉得呢这可能也是七国集团呢在这个跟中国打交道的时候，中国呢之所以显得很谨慎，那么呢就是我们其实强调的呢就是不要呢不要有太多的这种意识形态的这样的东西去强调，那么应该是一个呢是一个开放的态度。那么在这里面呢这个其实呢刚才呢这个柯顿教授也提到，就是呢1999年就是G20呢在诞生的时候 实际上还是呢 G7 倡议召开的，就是 G20 的这个财长会。那么我想呢，就是想能不能请你再谈一下，就是G7 在1999年当时呢这个倡议召开 G20 的时候，当时的这个选择标准是什么？就是它一个 club 它肯定是要有一些标准的，那么是怎么样的，就是当时呢选出了这个20国的这样的一个 member。
I'll get to that in a moment, but let me comment on your introduction. The G7 does not worry at all about the BRICS when they have their summits. The BRICS have twice as many summits each year, as you know, than the G7 does. They're having a summit in Hangzhou, where the G7 is not. The demand for global governance is great and growing. When the powers that count get together to do it collectively rather than individually, and Russia's behavior in Ukraine is done completely individually and unilaterally, and no country of consequence in the world stands with Mr. Putin's Russia on that, the better. One of the great tragedies of Russia's suspension from the G8 is that before that, Russia was the great connector. It was a member not only of the G20, but of the G8 and the BRICS too. It brought those two together and played a very important role. And not just on the old state-to-state disputes of a bygone past. Our biggest enemies are non-state ones. Terrorism, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, germs, the ones that killed Torontonians when SARS struck, and those in China too, climate change, financial markets, right? The government of the United States did not directly cause that crisis, right? It was markets and the market agents behind it. So the most powerful leaders, the most powerful governments, the most powerful countries in the world need to come together to confront those common non-state security threats. That's why we need Russia back and fast. In 1997, sometimes the most powerful leaders of the world's most powerful countries are slow learners. I mean, after all, if you've gotten the top job in a really big country, you're pretty self-confident. It's tough. You know, if you're an American Treasury Secretary, to go to the Treasury Secretary of Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Indonesia and say, please tell me how the financial system works, right? That was the 2011 meeting. And the Asian-Turn financial crisis was incremental, right? Thailand, who cares? Korea, The United States of America has command and control of the armed forces of South Korea, right? So that really mattered to them. So as you move towards these compounding crises, Russia going down, there was an ad hoc response by the Americans, said, let's round up a group of, first it was a G22, an ad hoc group, you know, for a meeting. And then it was a group of 33, because more countries wanted in. But that was too cumbersome, and actually too American-centric. The meetings took place in Washington. It was Bill Clinton at an APEC meeting who was talked into doing it by the leader of Singapore in the first instance. So it was really Paul Martin who said, look, we've got to make this more permanent with a more fixed membership and a built-in agenda. And we've got to not just pick an arbitrary number, although 20 sounds nice. We've got to set the criteria, and thus it was systemic significance. By the time you get to 1999, You can be systemically significant, even if you're very small, but you can be connected enough to bring the rest of the world down. Indonesia was the first after Thailand, but then Russia and Brazil and others had come. So the criteria of systemic significance, big enough, connected enough, were the two key ones, hence this new criteria. There was a fuss over membership, and all of this was finally decided in a meeting in the Office of the Treasury in Washington, D.C. on April 24th, where the final cut was made. There was actually a 20th country, a member, it was Nigeria, but it had blotted its copybook, so it wasn't invited to the first one and has never been invited since, because at the time the leader of Nigeria basically was engaging in the antithesis of democratic governance. So there was democracy as sort of the third criteria on the list. Systemic significance in a world of global connectivity meant geography shouldn't matter. And some people say, well, there aren't enough African countries, is that right? Well, there was supposed to be Nigeria, but not just not because it was African, but because it was systemically significant. And there was a few derogations from the list. The Americans wanted Saudi Arabia, and they got it. It's arguably systemically. You talked about oil prices, 100. I think in 1998, the world price of oil went from 100 U.S. dollars a barrel. Now it, back then it was 8, right? So if you want to see volatility, Saudi Arabia had been traditionally the great stabilizer. That may be changing. The finance ministers of the G7, with Germany as the chair, basically came to the realization that they couldn't cope on their own. They had begun to invite a few more people, including China. China was the first guest of the G7 Finance Ministers Forum. But by the time they moved through in 1999, they had decided you needed a bigger, a better club, and different countries had formula. The Germans had two. There was a fight about, or a fuss about membership. People wanted in, different lists were circulated. China, by the way, was on everybody's list. But then when you get to the leaders of the Cologne summit, that's where you have the leaders agreeing that they needed the G20 for finance. So in the Cologne communique, you get what could probably be called best an endorsement or an authorization of a group that had been designed and composed in Washington, D.C. By Paul Martin and Larry Summers. So it's not, it's only partially true, as I said, that the G20 was a child of the G7, G8 parent. It was still the G7 at the finance minister's level. It was actually separately constructed because, to be frank, the United States of Larry Summers and the Canada of Paul Martin, they are Asia-Pacific countries, right? Back in Germany, in continental Europe, right? You're not as aware of Asia as, the North Americans are. So you had more pain being felt in North America from the Asian part of the Asian financial crisis. So a delicate blend, almost amazing, given that history and the competition, that I think they got the membership right. It's endured for so long and has done the job. Those in the audience may, when we get to question period, have candidates. We should add this country or that country. And you may have criteria. And if it's big enough and connected enough, well, fine. We'll have a look at it. But it doesn't fit the formula to say, we have no representative of the Nordic states. You hear that, right? Or the Caribbean, or name another group, because in the 21st century, it's much less about geography than it was before, right? It's about capability and connectivity and openness. Part of connectivity, I mentioned finance, but it does, of course, extend to, you know, the free flow of information, so has political dimensions as well.
确实呢，如果回到呢这个，就是1999年，当时呢这个 G7七国集团的倡议呢，这个召开 G20 的这个财长会，那么当时呢，这个从这个选择成员资格来讲呢，就是刚才呢，所讲的，就是一个呢，就是必须是一个具有系统重要性的国家，同时呢还必须有地区代表性。那么我觉得呢，这个呢，这个总的来讲呢，就是这个设计啊，就是还是呢，这个考虑到了，就是这个新的机制一定要有它的这个代表性，同时呢，也要有它的这个有效性。那么怎么样的呢，在这个代表性、有效性兼顾的情况下，去做一个这种新的这种全球治理的这样的一个安排。但是呢，这个我感觉呢，现在呢，也有一个比较大的问题，就是回到就是。如果说不是在 crisis 的情况下，不是在危机的情况下，那么在 G20 当中呢，就是现在呢，就是面临的问题，就是不同的国家呢，它的这个经济阶段，就是它的经济复苏的情况也不一样，然后呢，它的这个经济政策也不一样。如果是在这样一种国家之间的差异这么大的情况下，怎么样的才能够，如果是从 G7 的这种经验来看，让 G20 呢也能够变得呢，就是在这种差异，在这个国家之间的差异啊分化的情况下，提高 G20 的有效性啊，我不知道在这方面有没有就是说 G7 的经验。
Well, the G20 as we know it now represents about a strong majority of the people on the planet. 80 or 90% of the gross domestic product, a strong majority of the military capability, and a large number of other specialized capabilities as well. So if you need some form of a leadership group, and we have at the United Nations and elsewhere since the start, the permanent five of the United Nations Security Council, China's been a leader there since, the early 1970s, then this 20 is the right club by that criteria. And it's worked increasingly effectively as inside the G20, the relative capability ratios have changed. The old G7 countries have gone down, and until lately, the BRICS and the emerging ones have gone up. And that's why IMF voice and vote reform was done once in 2005 and again by 2015. We do have a little problem this year. The G7's going down pretty flat. And most of the BRICS are too, Russia, Brazil, South Africa. So we're really looking to China, 6.7 growth, and India, 7%, if you believe there are statistics. These are the big two locomotives of growth. So if China needs a co-leader, maybe Mr. Modi. But we'll have to see, even though they could bond in the BRICS, whether those two will do it in the G20. I do note, my Indian friends tell me that there's a bit of a territorial dispute between China and India, so it's not all happy harmony between the two. But I think the answer to your question on effectiveness is they should start working as much as they did before, two summits a year. Secondly, they should meet longer when they do get together. We need them to spend more time awake working together at Hangzhou than some of them have spent on the plane flying to get there and flying home, right? That's at the leadership level. Two summits a year, they're very busy people, but they should just, you know, adjust the apps on their iPhones or devices. So they could all, most of them show up to give a speech in New York at the United Nations General Assembly each September, or late September. They could all show up at the same time and have another G20 summit there. I mean, the BRICS do it twice a year. Why can't the rest of the G20 members too? And that would deepen the association of the G20 with the entire UN family, right? They could have sessions with non-G20 members of the UN whose leaders are there at the same time. And if some of the big issues for Hangzhou, and they are implementing the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, ratifying and implementing the United Nations Paris Accord on climate change, right? I think that's the kind of architecture we need. We also need more ministerial meetings of G20 ministers. A few times the foreign ministers have met. That didn't happen in the Hangzhou year. I think we need to bring it back. And G20 ministers responsible for the environment and climate change have never met. Maybe Chancellor Merkel should do that for her G20 year next year. If President Xi has admirably put green growth, green finance, the Paris Agreement on climate change as his priorities, shouldn't we have our G20 environment ministers meet? The energy ones did, the agriculture ones did, the trade ones did, the labor and employment minister did. So if you just follow his priority agenda, those environmental issues are more important for him and Hangzhou than, say, the agriculture ones. So there's a lot we could do to deepen the involvement. And one could go out to the engagement groups. At the Brisbane summit, the leaders admirably agreed to reduce the gender gap in the workforce by 25% by 2025. I think they meant bringing more women into the workplace and not throwing the men in it out of jobs. But it was only a year later when Turkey hosted that we got a women's 20. If you look at President Xi's foreign minister list, the 10 big deliverables for Hangzhou, number 9, I think it is entrepreneurship. So I think we need a new engagement group, a formal one, for young entrepreneurs to contribute as a new deficit-free source of global growth. So there's a lot more to do, I think, to deepen the institutionalization and the community within the G20. And in some instances, they could learn from the BRICS, because the BRICS, as you know, have, in a number of important ways, gone a lot further than the G20 ones have.
确实现在呢这个我觉得呢就是在 G20 当中啊就是呢从有效性的角度来讲呢这个确实呢这个当然08年09年呢这个是应对金融危机的时候是最有效的，那么在那之后呢有效性呢应该说呢是 G20 面临的一个问题。那么刚才呢这个柯顿教授提到的一些呢一些这种改进的措施，怎么样的让 G20 呢能够变得更加有效，包括呢，有一些呢，这个新的这种，在这个制度方面的创新， 那么但我觉得呢，现在呢，就是说大家仍然是一个非常关心的一个问题，就是也正是你的研究啊，就是 G20 的它这个到底这个领导人达成的共识怎么样的提高呢，这个它的这个遵守的状况。那么在杭州呢，我们也会发布一个呢，就是杭州的行动计划，然后呢同时呢这个配合这个行动计划呢，也会发布一个杭州的这个问责评估报告，就是怎么样的让领导人在杭州达成的这种共识在后杭州时代能够真正的在二十国当中啊都能够大家呢这个去落实。那么我不知道这个方面呢，就是从你的长期的研究，就是包括 G7 的这个遵守，然后到 G20 的这个 compliance， 就是这种问责评估，那么你觉得怎么样的在这个 G20 的这样的这个当中，包括在杭州，我们怎么样的去改进就是 G20 的这个承诺的这个遵守的状况？
You're quite right, and I mentioned the famous Pittsburgh promise to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies, still not done. So it's all about implementation. And the sustainable development goals of the UN, they're not going to implement them successfully themselves. That's why implementing the UN sustainable development goals is President Xi's second priority for the Hangzhou summit. And the Chinese host, President Xi, when he outlined his vision in December, he had four eyes. The Turks had four eyes the year before. One of the Turkish eyes was implementation. They did an inadequate job of delivering. Implementation was not one of President Xi's four eyes, but if you read the speech, it was actually a fifth one, although it didn't make it into the list. So some reason to believe that he and the Chinese presidency cares. So I think we need lots more monitoring, and on some issues in Hangzhou, they are promising monitoring and even creating an index to measure progress. This is on structural reform, nine principles, but not just principles, a monitoring mechanism, an index, that which is measured, which is treasured. But amongst the accountability architecture, they've looked to themselves, their own ministers, to do it and report back. They've asked multilateral organizations to do it. But of course, these are the multilateral organizations they control, they fund. So is the IMF going to say, you know, China, you failed at knowing it needs, oh, and please, you know, give more money to the IMF next year. There's a dynamic there at work, which is why I think independent accountability monitoring is needed. And that's what we in the G20 research group with our friends in a global network do it. We do it in partnership. One of our core partnerships is our colleagues in the Russian Federation in Moscow. And we've kept on doing that, you know, despite the suspension of the Russian Federation in our sister G7-8 research group. But this is China's years. These are China's promises. These are President Xi's commitments that he's gotten all of the other most powerful leaders of the most powerful countries in the world. He is the one who should most want them to be implemented, which is why I think we need the citizens of China as much as possible to join us in independently monitoring the implementation of his and their commitments. You could leave it for the G20 governments to monitor implementation themselves, but I don't know of any university anywhere in the world where students are allowed to give themselves their own grades, so that shouldn't be true in the G20. You need independent monitoring public transparent, because after all, they're supposed to be governing for us, right? And if we can't ask politicians to keep their own promises, then we've got bigger problems than we thought.
好，由于时间关系，我们把这个中西。